Everybody, welcome back to Indie Game Business. Dan is living his best life on the back of a motorcycle somewhere in Texas this week. So you are stuck with me and the totally awesome Pebs in the background, making sure the questions are going to get answered and all of that kind of good stuff. And today we are talking about building and growing a game development studio with our guest, Paxton Galvanic.
Yep, you got it. Said Galvanic, but you got Galvanic. Good job.
Close enough. You did great. Yes. Who's also in my neck of the woods over here in North Carolina. So, Paxton, let's start with, tell us how you originally got into the industry and then walk us through your career up to this point.
So, my career did not start in game development. I would say that started about 14 or 15 years ago. So, I guess we'll start with how I got into game development. At the time, I was the CEO of a advertising and marketing firm in the New York, New Jersey area, doing very, very corporate things for Verizon Wireless and Bristol-Myers Squibb in the Bank of New York. And it was super, super boring, but it was advertising. So we got to do websites and TV commercials, but I was going to a lot of meetings and suits. How I broke into the industry, I was a gamer since I was a little kid. I remember playing on the Atari, and I remember the Nintendo. I was in the 80s playing. And I remember when my dad brought home the Nintendo, the NES system, and I was playing Zelda and Mario Brothers. And then I got a PC, and I was playing all the Sierra games, the King's Quest, the Police Quest. I was playing everything, Ultima. I was doing it all. So I've always been a gamer. But how I got into the industry was, I would say in 2008 or so, I was running a clan, a community of video gamers. We were playing World of Warcraft, and we were playing America's Army, Battlefield, a whole bunch of games. And I actually witnessed a pretty bad accident in North Carolina, where I saw a car flip over multiple times, and there were people injured. I actually helped on the scene, pulled a couple people from a car, and administered life-saving techniques on them. And it ended up that I did learn a lot of this stuff from the game America's Army, where I had to sit through this whole PowerPoint presentation to become a medic in the game. And I ended up using some of those life-saving techniques on a few of these people that I pulled from the car. And it got put on Fox News, and it was on a whole bunch of shows. And I realized that there are a lot of good things that could happen from video games. It's not just all this bad stuff you hear about in the news. It's not all this this doom and gloom that video games make people mass murderers. And it's, you know, there's a lot to be learned from video games. So at that point, I decided, how could I transition my life into video game development? I want to better the community itself. I want to be part of this amazing community that taught me something that I was able to, you know, help people in a really difficult situation. So at that point I said, let me kind of transition my career and see how I can get into gaming. And then I ended up becoming a partner in a business consulting recruitment firm that I ran a division for video game development. So, and we can kind of go into that later. So that's how I broke into the industry. My career progression was, I got a degree from Rutgers in New Jersey. I was doing IT and psychology. I dual majored there. I was doing advertising and marketing for years up in New York and New Jersey. Then I became that partner at the Chatham Group, ran that for a few years, where I was helping different studios grow their teams and was doing business consulting. I was working with Activision and a bunch of 2K studios and Tripwire and Gameloft, a whole bunch of them. Then I decided I wanted to be in-house at a studio, and I transitioned to Funcom in North Carolina, where I became the general manager of the North Carolina office, where I handled all of the administration, the operations, the HR. I also ran global initiatives, so I was working with Norway and Portugal and Romania and on the operations and HR side. So I was helping grow that entire studio from, I think when I started, we had about 200 or so people. By the time I left 5.5 years later, we were at about 450. So we more than doubled the size of Funcom. We were working on Dune Awakening. We worked on Conan Exiles. We worked on a whole bunch of other projects. So I met a lot of great people while I was with Funcom. Then I had an opportunity about a year and a half ago to form my current studio, which is Studio Hermitage. It's a transmedia creative firm. We are backed by the Embracer Group and part of their Amplifier division. So there's about, you know, 13 or 14 studios within the Amplifier, but we got some money from Swedish investors, and we now have a small studio. We're a remote studio. We're making an IP called Our Brilliant Ruin, and we can kind of talk about that in a little bit if you want to dive into that. But we have been doing that for about a year and 3 months now, and just growing this right now. So that's a little bit about me. So
the I always love talking about Funcom because I still remember, and this was way back when GDC was in San Jose. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we all knew the folks over at Funcom because we were all right there in Chapel Hill and Raleigh as well. And we see the, you know, one GDC, they were literally standing out in front of, not the Moscone Center, wherever it was in San Jose, and handing out free copies of Anarchy Online. And we're all going, that's just like the sign of death right there. That's like when you're, because, you know, this is back in the day when you had to pay $40 for
right
an MMO before you started paying. And we were just like, oh God, that feels, I feel so bad for them. This, you know, yeah, the studio's obviously going to crash and burn. And it did. And
it absolutely, it definitely, Funcom had its ups and downs. I mean, I think Conan Exiles really helped bring the studio back to life. It was a success for the studio, and that was around 2017, 2018. So it was good to be part of that. I joined right at in 2018. So the studio was definitely ramping up at that point. But yeah, definitely ups and downs. The Secret World, you know, didn't do very well. But I mean, they've been around for 30 years now.
Yeah.
They've definitely ups and downs. I mean, there's games that you're like, oh, they did Age of Conan, they did Secret World, they did Anarchy Online, and all that. I mean, there's been so many games that have been done over the years with Funcom. It was a great studio to be part of. Like, I'm very thankful that I was part of it. I miss a lot of people over there. One of the reasons why I did get my investment with Studio Hermitage is because one of the people that was with me at Funcom went over to Amplifier and part of the Embracer. Mm-hmm. So he was able to, you know, bring us in.
And that is how business works in this industry.
You do a good job, you know people, you kind of prove yourself, and as people move, it's a very, very small industry, right? Like, everybody knows everybody. Don't burn any bridges, and just, you know, business development and making friends is wonderful. So
So, I mean, we've already got our first question coming in, and this is, I hope this is one of those shows where they nothing but audience question, because it makes my life so much easier. But Occupational Hazard on YouTube wants to know, how did you go about getting that investment?
Everybody asks about investments. I will say that lately the industry has been hit. It's been hit really hard. Investment money is hard to come by with inflation. Money is not cheap, as they say anymore. I was lucky enough to get my investment about a year and a half ago. So I think I'm a very rare case where I was not going out looking for VC money. I was very happy at Funcom. I was actually approached by this group, and they're part of the Embracer group. And at the time they said, we are looking to develop studios and find key people that can grow studios. And we have opportunities to give key groups of people money for great ideas. We want to make intellectual properties and grow them. Paxton, you've run companies. We have somebody else in mind that can be the creative side that I know you've worked with. And that's Justin Achille. He's one of our partners at Studio Hermitage. And he came from Paradox, where he actually, you know, 30 something years ago, he was with White Wolf Publishing. He was with CCP. He created the World of Darkness IP, vampires, werewolves, all that kind of stuff. If you've played tabletop games or even video games, he was with Paradox. He was at Red Storm working for a while on projects like Werewolves Within. He worked on Star Trek. He's worked on a bunch of things. So he's our creative officer. So he had the whole creative side taken care of. My job was to be the strategy, money, hiring, operations side of the company. So the Amplifier team, you know, I've worked with some of them before. They said, you know, let's bring these people together, you know, hopefully give them an opportunity to make something great, give them the funding they need to do it, and help grow it. So I am a very rare case where I did not have to sit there and hustle and be on the streets and ask for money and get different rounds of funding and seed fund. It's not something that I've been part of. I was blessed with this opportunity, and I know it's very rare. But it was from the relationships that I built before of people that have moved on to, you know, other organizations that saw what me and Justin and other people could do, and they brought us together to make this company. So much
of this industry comes down to, it's like you said, it's a very small industry. So it wasn't necessarily that random that you got this, you had built that base of contacts and networks and folks that you know and reputation for years. And that is, but I mean, also to be fair, it is easier for those of us who have been doing this for 20, 25, 30 years to find those opportunities more so than, you know, a lot of the new studios coming up because they don't have that network of connections.
The connections. Yeah. It's all about the connections. And it's a very, like I said, it's a very small industry. And as people move around, they get into new roles. You may have producers that move into, you know, publishing lead roles, and you never know. People move around so much that people that you worked with, you know, 5-10 years ago may be in roles that may be able to offer investment opportunities. And it's all, this industry is all about, you know, making good connections and just keeping those connections and being a good person. You know, nobody wants to give money to a bad person or somebody with an ego, or, I mean, you want to be around good people. So I hope that I'm a good person. I try to be a good person. When they saw myself and Justin, we actually worked together at Funcom. He was one of our lead designers on the Dune Awakening survival game that's going to be coming out. So him and I worked together on that game. So when Embracer and Amplifier saw us, they said, well, we know you guys have worked together. You guys are friends. You guys worked at Funcom. We want to give you this opportunity to create a new studio and make a brand new intellectual property across multiple mediums. So, again, it was somebody that we knew.
Yeah. All right. So I want you to give us the other side of Embracer, because Embracer is not exactly the most loved organization out there right now.
Sure.
For the last year or so. You, although, have had a very different experience with them.
Yeah.
Tell us that side of the story, and not the usual doom and gloom that we hear.
Yeah. So I will preface this with, the entire industry is being hit really hard. It's not just on the Embracer side. If you looked at Epic Games, if you look at Activision recently, it's happening all over the place. And there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, it has to do with money not being cheap anymore. People aren't investing. The economy itself, the war. There's a whole bunch of reasons why we're at where we're at. What's funny, not funny, but 5 or so years ago, I was talking to the CEO of Funcom, Rui, and we were talking about the game development industry as a whole. And we were saying that it's not sustainable. Like, something's going to happen. And this was 5 years ago. We were looking at how much it costs to make games, especially AAA games, and the return on investment isn't there for the most part. So we were, I guess it was foreshadowing what was going to be happening with the industry as a whole. We were saying, you know, people have to find ways to make games. Game development has to be cheaper if you're going to have any type of return on your investment, you know, or you have to do things differently, or salaries need to be cut. There needs to be changes. So we kind of recognized this a couple years ago. So while we were making Dune Awakening, we were smart with our hiring, with our resources. On the Embracer side of things, I feel like Embracer is a good company at its heart. Lars, the CEO, he is a good guy. Like, I've spoken to him before. The company had good intentions in mind. The industry just got hit really hard, like every studio. I think the media kind of grappled onto Embracer and said, oh, look at these people. They're constantly chopping. But if you look at the numbers, it's close to what some of the other big studios did. I think what happened with Embracer was that it was chipping away. Like, a studio got closed here, a studio got closed here. It's 200 people here, it's 100 people. And again, that's not good. It's not good in general. But as opposed to somebody like Epic, that's like ripping the bandaid off, we're just letting go of 900 people. So I think the media just picked up on, okay, Embracer's doing it again, Embracer's doing it again. But it, for me, it's been really wonderful being part of the Embracer group. With my company, we are a transmedia company. So it's been nice having the Embracer umbrella of other companies that I'm able to work with on a daily basis. As an example, one of our projects, we're doing a comic book series. We get to work with Dark Horse. Dark Horse is an Embracer studio. I was able to easily talk to Dark Horse and say, here's our IP. Let's work together on this comic book project. They were able to get us some amazing writers and artists. I don't know if I'd have that door open to me if I wasn't part of the Embracer group. Asmodee is an Embracer group studio. We have had meetings with Asmodee about doing future projects and working with them with, you know, board games. So it's been really nice for me to be part of the Embracer group. And I'm not saying there hasn't been, you know, difficulties. I mean, with the company itself, there were cost-cutting initiatives that I think every studio had to do, and we made concessions on our end. That's not uncommon to any studio in the current environment. I think a lot of people are cutting back, being smart about investments, being smart about hiring, being smart about game development. How are they doing things cheaper, faster is kind of what's been happening lately. So I don't hold any ill will toward Embracer. I like being part of Amplifier, which is that investment group, which I think there's 12 or 13 studios that are part of that. And I like being part of the Embrace group. It's been a great opportunity for us. I don't know if I'd have any more security if I was with Activision or any of the other studios. It's the industry as a whole. And I think the media the media was pretty brutal to Embracer Group. And really, like I said, Lars is a good guy when it comes down to it at heart. And I think that they had the best intentions and deals fell through and they were trying to accomplish something that was difficult and it didn't go according to plan.
Like so many things in this industry they don't go according to plan. But no, that is good because, I mean, we haven't had a ton of folks on here that are actually in that ecosystem. And, the premise is fantastic because you're right. You can absolutely go, okay, look, we want to do a comic. We want to do a board game. You have all these other aspects of, knowledge to draw from and build. So, no, that was good. I appreciate that, Paxton.
Yeah.
All right. So this is a good one coming in from YouTube as well. Why go transmedia first? And then what order do you tackle each format?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think what we've seen, in general with video game development, a lot of times you have a great game idea. You're like, oh, here's a cool design idea. Let me build something around it. Let me create a story around it. Our case is a little bit different where we've said, let's create an intellectual property. So we actually took 6 months and we wanted to develop this world first. We wanted to create it. It's called Our Brilliant Ruin, and you can go to ourbrilliantruin.com and take a look at it. But we wanted to create this world first and foremost, and we wanted to flesh out some characters, the world, the story behind it, to then use different mediums to tell stories within that world. So we wanted to flesh out what this big encompassing thing felt like and the environments, just the conflicts, just lay all that out there. And then we wanted to enable, our own team plus external teams chances to tell stories within that world. We thought that would be a great opportunity to have some really rich storytelling. We've seen the success with things like Witcher and the things, even recently Fallout. I don't know if anybody's watched the Fallout series. I love Fallout. I mean, you could probably see some Fallout bobbleheads. And I mean, I think I've got Fallout 4 up here. Like, I love the Fallout series and I've binge watched the entire Fallout series. I mean, there's a great transmedia property right there. We wanted to do the same thing with what we're doing. We wanted to lay it all out there and use these mediums to tell different stories. So We're currently developing a video game that will tell a very different story from our comic book series. The comic book series is going to tell a completely different story than what's to be told with our tabletop role-playing game, which we're also doing an audio drama, which is going to be a dramatic story that's going to be different characters but and different storylines. But everything's going to kind of be within this world where it just adds to the richness of it. The first product we're releasing is a tabletop role-playing game, and we chose that product specifically to have a physical world and art Bible that people can go to. And it's a 300 page book. It's actually going to be free in about a couple months or two. We're going to offer it for free, but it will be a physical product that we offer people, but it's going to show you and give you a glimpse of our world. You can see characters, you can see creatures, you can see conflict. It's something that people can look at and then maybe want to tell their own story within. We are more than open to licensing agreements. If people want to make video games with our IP, if they want to do their own novels. We wanted to create something where it allows people to create their own stories. So, and having that first initial art and world Bible that is in your hand, 300 pages that you could just hand somebody and say, take a look at Our Brilliant Ruin. Here's your first glimpse at it. They can flip through and it's just easy to kind of recognize some of the features, some aspects of the world.
So. I guessed from your Discord name that you were a fan of Fallout as well.
Oh, with the Knight?
Yeah.
Brotherhood of Steel. Yeah. I mean, Knight is, I always play like the paladin character. I'm never a thief. And anytime I do a run through of a game, I'm never the assassin. I'm always the guy that, you know, heals and battles. I'm a knight. Like, that's just how I play.
Two shoes. Okay.
I'm a paladin and a knight. It's like, that's how I am. I don't necessarily think the Brotherhood of Steel is a good group. I don't know. Good. It's the right term. Everybody has their own agenda, but sure. Like, I'm always a knight character, or that type of class. So
coming in, God, y'all are making my life so easy today. And I want to get back to the Fallout stuff and just licensing it in general in the first place, sure. But I want to get through this stuff first. So Tyler on LinkedIn says, I'm definitely curious about starting my own studio, if only to have an LLC or a brand I can market my game ideas under. What are some good do's and don'ts for when I'm creating my own company?
Yeah, I have owned multiple companies over the years. I've owned LLCs. I've been part of C-Corps. I will tell you it is very easy to create your own LLC. And I've done it multiple times. I think BizFilings was who I used for years. But having a company that protects you as an individual is, I guess, paramount. Make sure that you protect yourself. You protect the things that you're creating. It makes it so that you're not liable, you know, financially for yourself if anything does happen with the business. So I would always suggest to people to create some sort of protection for yourself. And that goes into how you make the company and having contracts. I mean, I am big into making sure that we have fully fleshed out contracts for all of our contractors, our employees. We have handbooks, everything's spelled out. I mean, I like to do things properly, legally. So
you're a paladin.
Yes, because I'm a paladin, I guess that's how it is. But I've just seen so many people get burned over the years because they didn't have a contract in place, and people have taken advantage of people. And I've said, you know what? I just want to have everything kind of in writing. I want to protect myself, my team, whatever it may be. So having a company to kind of have that, you know, it separates yourself from that. So somebody's not coming after your house if something falls through with the indie game that you've signed on to do. Because if you don't have a company, people can hold you personally liable for something. And the last thing you want to do is lose your house and your life because of a bad business decision. So I would say it's fairly easy to make an LLC, a limited liability corporation. That is definitely a way to go if you want to go that way. But then setting up your company properly is the next best step. I think it's under $1,000. It's maybe even a couple hundred dollars to create an LLC. So I will always suggest people to do that. If they're getting contractors and making something themselves, if they're creating their own IP, 100%, just make an LLC, put everything under the company, protect your assets.
I don't know how many times over the last 20, 25 years, I've seen a developer literally get a second mortgage and put their house up to get money for development in it. And I'm sitting there going, it's like, I understand the passion.
Yeah.
But given this industry, that is such a bad idea. There's even if you, Michael Brown from Vicarious had a talk a couple of conferences ago and said, even if you do everything right, you can still fail. And I'm like, dude, thanks. That is like the darkest title we have ever had. But I mean, it's true.
It's true. So, you never know what's going to happen. Just protect yourself. Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
All right. So back to Fallout in general, and then IPs we're going to talk about, you know, yours as well. I have the sinking feeling that we're getting ready to hit another one of these things where, oh my God, everybody has to have a license. And I am a huge fan of using an IP and using that leverage of an existing fan base to do this sort of stuff. But we saw this when the Kim Kardashian mobile game came out, however many years ago. Then all of a sudden, every single pop star decided they wanted to have a game, and things went ape shit. And now we've got Fallout. And the thing to keep in mind is they have to do well. If Fallout had come out and just been shit, it would have been a disaster. Nothing. Yeah. But we're seeing, you know, the show is good. It's a little predictable if you've played the games, because you know who these players are, and you don't walk into the scenario going, oh, Vault-Tec is a wonderful company. It's like, right. No, the fuck they're not. They're right. Just like, but it still has to be good. Right. So one of the questions that just came up, and I'm going to see if I didn't lose it. Yes, from James on YouTube. How do you validate a new IP if it's not something, I mean, you're creating your own. That's one thing.
Right.
But when you're looking at stuff like you've done with Conan and, you know, all these other properties, what are the steps that you go through to validate that that IP is going to be worth working with?
Yeah, James, that's a good question. And so in our situation, we have this transmedia wheel that we are using, and at the core of our wheel is our IP and is video game development, because we're part of the Embracer Group and Amplifier. And we know that our biggest return on investment will probably be from video game development. So we know that going into a tabletop role-playing game, you know, environment, we're not going to get a 12x return on investment, but it's going to give people an opportunity to get a glimpse of the world that we're creating. It's our job is to kind of give people different mediums that that show them different stories and aspects that don't necessarily cost a lot of money to create. We knew that we were going to have to create this IP anyway. Like if we're making a video game, we know that we were doing something new. We were going to have to do it anyway, but we decided to monetize the IP creation beforehand and then test it with different products. You may want to test it with a board game and see how that goes. There's a lot of organizations, like I think Panda is one of them, that allows you to create your own board game and test your IP. We're putting a lot of effort into creating our community first. So I have a great marketing team with I have a marketing manager and a community manager. We're building a community around our IP right now. We have our own Discord. We're doing fun events. So we're just sending out these bits of transmedia and seeing what the community thinks. We're not saying this is how it is, you know, this isn't how everything should be. It's like, what is your take on it? What do you like? What do you not like? And then we can kind of shift what we're creating in the future toward what people like and what they don't like. We've thrown a lot of different cool things into our IP. So we have an upstairs, downstairs drama. There are creatures. So there's a horror aspect to it. We have this lost technology called Silicinetics, these huge machines. So there are things that we've presented people in our world, and we want to see how the community, you know, gravitates toward those things. So we may see that people love monster hunting, and that may be something cool that we put toward our next game. Or we may see that this upstairs downstairs drama between aristocrats and true folk, and there's a lot of excitement about that. So we may want to do more of these dramatic series, and maybe that's what our TV series might look like in the future. So we're testing the IP across these multiple mediums with smaller projects. Like we're doing an audio drama right now. It's going to be a 10 episodic series audio drama. It's going to be released on, you know, Spotify and YouTube, but there's not a big cost involved in that. I mean, we have to do some voiceover recording, and we actually got a few celebrities, which is kind of exciting. Mark Meer, who's the voice of Commander Shepard, is going to be one of them from Mass Effect. So we have a couple other ones, but Mark signed up. So any of you video gamers can hear Mark play one of our characters in our audio drama. So that's just one of them. But we're testing the water with an audio drama and seeing what kind of community likes the audio drama. And I was blessed to hire a great team at Studio Hermitage, where I have a writer, designer that helped write the TTRPG that also has experience doing these audio dramas. She did one for for Vampires the Masquerade. It was called Port Saga. And she has experience doing that. So I have somebody on my team that not only is a great writer, that is a designer, that can also do these type of like audio dramas. And it's really important to find great people to work alongside of you. And I'm sure, Jay, you're going to want to talk about, like, what does it take to build a great team and how do you do that? It's finding great people that are passionate about what they do. And then my job is to kind of enable those people, not get in their way. I don't micromanage the team. I just find amazing people that work well together. And I make sure that I have the right strategy and they can do what they need to do. So I've enabled Rachel to do that for our audio drama project, just like Justin was the head of our TTRPG, because he's done those for years. So anyway, I hope that answered the question.
We can get into the hybrid. I'm more fascinated now with this audio drama.
Yeah.
What you've done, or so your audio drama, you're basically talking about an old radio show.
Yeah.
I mean, and
it's 10 episodes that we're releasing.
You see anymore.
No, it's not, but it's going to be 10 episodes. Each of them is about 25 to 30 minutes long. We have some celebrities that are going to, some hopefully, you know, we're trying to land one really big one right now. But, you know, we're going to go into voiceover recording. We're going to do some audio editing on that. We're going to be releasing these little episodes right before Christmas time. So, yeah, it's going to be like you want to sit in the car and drive on a trip. You get to listen to these episodes, and it's going to be a story, you know, with characters, and there's going to be music and adventure and drama itself. So, yes, it's something fun and different. There's not a huge cost involved when you compare it to like video game development, but it's just another one of those spokes in the transmedia wheel that people that are interested in those things that want to listen to the, you know, dramatic series, they can gravitate toward that, as opposed to, you know, somebody may not be into tabletop role-playing games, but they drive to work every day and they might want to get a glimpse into Our Brilliant Ruin. They could do it through this audio drama.
And we've worked with a lot of comic book companies here at my firm over the years as well. And I've always said there's a very clear connection between a lot of the indie comic book publishers and indie game developers. The struggles that one sees, the other sees. It's very, very, very similar. And so bringing these different aspects to, you know, like you said, those spokes, that is a wonderful way of attaching it, because you're not going out, you're not sitting down and going, okay, we're going to make this one game. Yep. And then we're going to have like five or six other games that come from it as well. It's like you're spreading it across these different, I mean, it's transmedia, but you're not going ridiculously expensive.
Right. We're not putting our eggs in one basket, which is really important. So the last thing you want to do is have everything riding on that one project, because, I mean, if you're a game developer, you know not every project makes it. I mean, I've been involved with so many projects that never got released. And then I've been involved in teams that projects never got released. I mean, I could tell you so many stories over the years of teams that I've worked with that those studios are no longer here because things happen, because people put all their eggs in one basket. So our attempt here is to have all those spokes, have people gravitate toward the IP through multiple mediums. And at the end of the day, like, we are still making a video game. I have a video game development team internally. We're prototyping. I can't talk about that at all. We're still prototyping what that looks like right now, but I do have a team of people that are working on something exciting, and ultimately we want to drive people to that video game. I mean, hopefully we get a great return on investment there. So
Chaotic Insight Media from YouTube has, you know, along the same lines, you know, they're building a transmedia project as well. He asked, do you suggest a more physical release, like a comic book before a game? And the next question, you know, after that is how are you approaching each stage?
Yeah, we're doing that because we saw value in releasing smaller products before releasing an expensive video game, because to do a decent game, I mean, it takes time. It takes time, money, effort. Comic books, I mean, I'm working with Dark Horse. They have been an amazing partner. And I'm, like I said, I'm lucky to be part of the Embracer Group, where I got that door opened to me through Dark Horse. We are working with their team. We're doing multiple episodes. We're going to be doing an omnibus at the end, like a graphic novel. That product will be released before our video game gets released. So our intention to be a transmedia company is that every few months we have a product that hits the market, a different type of product. So it may be a comic book. Then the next month it may be a supplement to our TTRPG. The next month it may be an audio drama episode. So we'd like to piece out different glimpses into our world before the big game gets released that may have the biggest investment that our investors put behind it. So it's going to cost the most to do a video game. And being part of Dark Horse, I mean, the cost there is a small fraction of what it would be to make a video game. So I would suggest, if you have the budget to do some of these smaller transmedia projects, get it out there. Start building a community around your intellectual property. Because at the end of the day, when you start releasing some of these bigger products, you have a community that's already kind of hungry for more. They want to see more. They want to hear more stories. You've already built that community. So that's why I do have a marketing team that is trying to build that community, that is trying to build a positive group of people that are into what we're doing. We have people that are cosplaying our characters already without even releasing our first product. They're just seeing what we're doing on our website and they're getting really excited about it. So these are the type of things that we want. So by the time we have these larger products that people are like, yeah, I want to buy the video game that Studio Hermitage is doing for Our Brilliant Ruin. That sounds exciting. So instead of this unknown that nobody's ever heard of, you know, Our Brilliant Ruin, all of a sudden we try to hit the market and put hundreds of thousands of dollars into marketing. Do we get a publisher? Like, these are all questions that, you know, a lot of studios are trying to figure out. We're just trying to kind of build the hype beforehand.
So, but you touched on budget, and that just flows perfectly into the next question here. When you're creating transmedia options for a video game, Tyler wants to know, how much should I budget for these projects? Obviously, I should spend more on the game development, but I'm curious if there's a good percentage of the budget I should be dedicating towards transmedia, marketing, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I would say every transmedia spoke in that wheel is going to be different. It's going to require a different budget. Dark Horse, you know, they're splitting the cost with us. So it's not something where we are putting all the money out of pocket for something that they're going, and there's a risk on their end as well. They're doing the solicitation of hobby shops for us. So we found a partner that was behind what we're doing that's willing to take the risk with us. So there's a good opportunity there. But you will have to specify, like, I don't know how much money, Tyler, you're working with or other people are working with. You have to figure out what makes sense for you and your company. Like, for our audio drama, we knew that was a very small percentage, like, compared to game development. Like, games take millions of dollars to create, like, especially if you're doing, like, AA. I mean, indies, you could do it for more than that, but it's expensive to have a team of people, especially full-time employees that have salaries and 401ks. I mean, it's a costly thing to do a video game development team. But it's a small percentage to have some of your team members do smaller transmedia projects. So the way I have my studio set up is that I do have a brand team. It's probably half of my studio that is focused on these transmedia projects. They're doing script writing, they're doing marketing. But then I have a team that's solely focused on video game development, that 100% of their time is focused on that. So when I do my budgets, I split my brand team across the multiple projects, and then the video game team is kind of their own tab, their own budget that has you know, its own money behind it. And I have to show that to Amplifier and Embracer. Like, I share, like, the company is not owned by me. It is owned by Amplifier and Embracer. I just run it. I mean, so it's just different. Like, so I share our budget with them. They get to review what I'm doing, our intentions. We kind of look at the market. We look at how much video games or how much comic books sell. I will tell you, like, when we looked at those projects, we know that a comic book may have a 1.2 times return on investment. As to a video game, like, we want more than a 3x return on our investment on that video game. So we know that by doing a comic book, the margins are small. Like, so we need to keep the cost down to get a, we know that we're not going to get a huge return on investment, but it's going to build the excitement of our IP and build the community, and tell different stories. So I can't tell you exactly how much money you should be spending for your different transmedia projects. And it's not necessarily like a set percentage. We kind of just look at the big picture and figure out what projects work for our team. Like, I wouldn't have done an audio drama unless I had somebody on my team that had experience doing that and presented it to us. And then as we look at future projects for Studio Hermitage, for Our Brilliant Ruin, we're looking at what we could leverage within the Embracer Group or other organizations. Where can we have these connections, and what can we do? What's cost effective? What's not cost effective? So we kind of take it case by case.
So on the, lane of budgeting and people, James on YouTube says, for setting up a small studio where you don't have the budget for at least one of every role, how do you prioritize the roles you initially hire and which ones to leave until later and or never? Yeah.
That is also a very good question. So we phased out our development process and our staffing plan. Like, I have a staffing plan that says, okay, during concept phase, we need these type of people. We need, let's say a tech artist and a tech director and a game designer. During pre-production, we need these type of people, and here's a rough cost for having these people. When we go into production, here's the type of people that we need to make this game. So I have it phased out every single step of the process between, I think we have concepting, prototyping, pre-production, production. So I know that we have to ramp up at certain points, and I know how much those different points will cost based on median salaries and, cost per employee. So you kind of have to map that out properly to know how much a game's going to cost. So I know I may only need, a full production team, you know, for a year, as opposed to I'm going to need a tech director for 2 years because they're going to be part of that concepting and prototyping and pre-production phases. So you have to figure out the minimum viable team that you need to create what you're creating. So if you've done any type of game development, you know the different disciplines that you need. And I will say for a smaller team, I don't plan on being this enormous, you know, AA or AAA studio. I mean, we're going to be about 25 people, I'd say, is my studio for this first project. So it is a small to mid-sized studio. And I know that I'm not going to have specialists in all the different disciplines. I know that I'm not going to have, you know, AI programmers. So I think with smaller studios, you have to find very good generalists that can do multiple things for you. So if you find a gameplay programmer, they may be good at network programming or AI programming, or they may not be the absolute best at it, but they are great at a bunch of different things. So I think finding generalists is an important part of growing a indie to small studio. The last thing you want is to find this absolute specialist that, you know, is your console programmer. And it's like, great, it would be wonderful to have a console programmer if I'm making something on the Xbox, but if that's the only thing they're focused on, I mean, they're very specialized. Can they help me with my gameplay program? Can they help me with network programming? Maybe, maybe not. So my suggestion would be to find the generalists, find people that can do different things within your team. That way you don't need a whole bunch of specialists. You can, you know, rely on one generalist or two generalists to do the job. So.
And that's another good aspect of being part of that Embracer family, is you don't have to necessarily worry about what am I going to outsource? Who am I going to find to do this? You've got access to a lot of different experts, you know, in that bigger group that you can pull from. But that's, you know, that's the other thing to remember, is what can you effectively outsource, and understanding what your outsourcing options are. That way you're not just like picking up general experts for a short period of time.
Right. And I do feel really blessed with that. And like I was mentioning, it is nice to be part of an organization that has all these different options that I can pick from. And I know not everybody, I'm sure most people aren't in the same situation as me. So I know it's not comparing apples to apples, but there may be resources out there that you could leverage. There may be organizations within your community that might want to partner with you. You know, I know that I probably will need a publisher at some point. Embracer has THQ and PlayOn and Coffee Stain. Like, there are people that I might be able to call on if it's the right opportunity, because I'm part of this kind of ecosystem or this umbrella that's the Embracer group. But like I said, not everybody has that, and I'm sorry for that. I definitely am positive and I can benefit from that. But there's resources out there that you can leverage, and building those relationships with people that, you know, that you can call upon is invaluable. So.
Yeah. So in a more general sense, you know, going back a few steps, what was it that made you decide to commit so fully to Our Brilliant Ruin?
Also a great question, occupational hazard. So we, when we talked to Amplifier and we kind of presented what we wanted to do as a company, we actually pitched three intellectual properties. So Justin Achille, brainchild of all of these, he's been kind of stewing on these IPs. We pitched three very different IPs. The other ones we are going to keep close to the vest, because they may be future IPs that we want to grow at our company. We're not going to be solely the Our Brilliant Ruin studio. That is something that we wanted to focus on in the initial periods of development. We chose this IP because it had the smallest scope. So if you look at what Our Brilliant Ruin is, it's not that we've created this entire vast world that you're going to explore. You're looking at one little peak of our world. It's called the Dramark. It's this one area that has very intimate stories and locations. You're not traversing space and planets and different races of people. The scope of it was smaller and manageable with a smaller team. Other IPs, I mean, they were more grand, and we might have needed a bigger team of people to handle storytelling within those IPs. So we decided to keep the scope down. It was manageable. We could tell those personal stories that we wanted to tell. So, yeah, control scope is what that's why we chose it.
So Nathan on LinkedIn said, is there a particular type of media now or in the future that you're most excited about working with?
I love video game development. I mean, that's the core of our business. I've always, like I said, I've always been a gamer. I'm excited about that. But, you know, I love what's happening with the streaming services. If I can do a TV series, I mean, I watch all of the streaming service, you know, shows. Like, I've watched all The Witcher. I've watched all of the Wheel of Time. I've watched all of the Fallout. Like, I binge watch all of the streaming service shows. And I love what's, I feel like the production quality of all of them have gotten so much better over the years, where prior to maybe, you know, 5-10 years ago, I mean, they were okay. But lately, I absolutely love what's happening with streaming services. I would love to be part of that with our Brilliant Rune. I could see this being an episodic series on shown on Prime or on Netflix. I mean, that is exciting to me to be, you know, hopefully someday have that for our Brilliant Rune. But at the core, I mean, making video games is where we see the biggest return on investment. I love video games. Like I said, I want to do different types of games. I don't necessarily want to do the same type of game. Like, we'd love to make different types of games. I'm actually talking to a studio that may be licensing our IP and doing a very different game than what we're going to be making. So we're already talking licensing opportunities for our Brilliant Rune with other teams. So those are options. I still love video games. So
It really is. It's, and I like to think back and reflect on when we as the game industry used to have to go hat in hand to a lot of these IPs and go, will you please let us make a game? Right. And now that has very much been flipped on its head and yep. all of these other industries. And so that brings us to our next question from Tyler. If there's an existing IP that I have a great idea for a game, how do you recommend going about that pitch? Are there any tips and tricks that I should be aware of when you're approaching one of these IP companies?
I would say if it's something that you know that you're going to be putting your time, your effort, your money behind, just make sure you protect that intellectual property. So I've gone ahead and trademarked things. We have copyrights. So there is a cost involved in that. The last thing you want to do is pitch your wonderful IP to somebody that has not, I mean, nobody signed an NDA or nobody signed anything, and all of a sudden your idea gets snatched up from you and there's nothing you can do about it. So if you have a great IP, try to protect it, protect what you've created. There are a lot of studios that are looking for intellectual properties. I know I've talked to many of them. There have been many of them within the Embracer Amplifier group that have great game ideas, but they don't know, they don't have an IP to put behind it. They could skin it with whatever they want. I mean, there's a studio right now called Palindrome that had a great game idea. They're part of Amplifier, and they went to Asmodee and they are doing a Legend of the Five Rings game. They are using that IP for their game because there was just a good fit there. So right now, IPs, people want to find IPs. They want to grow IPs. Asmodee wanted to spread the Legend of the Five Rings, and Palindrome was like, yeah, we'll just reskin our game and we'll make this game a Legend of the Five Rings game. So that just shows you that there's people out there that are interested in making games with certain IPs. I mean, Legend of the Five Rings has been around for a bit now, so it was easy to say, yes, there's already kind of a community that has known about that IP. But if you have a new IP, I mean, if it's exciting, I'm sure that there's a lot of studios that are open to hearing about new IP pitches. But again, protect yourself. Make sure you're not giving away things for free. Make sure that you have people sign NDAs, that I know it's hard. If you're just getting into this and you're like, I want to share what I've done. I have a pitch deck. I've got this great IP. You're excited about it. I know it's hard to say, can you sign this NDA? Like, those are always difficult conversations, but most business professionals are used to signing things. And, you know, I would sign an NDA if you asked to share something with me, or, you know, protect yourself, make sure you dot your I's and cross your T's.
As long as you don't be one of those people who walks into a meeting at a conference and goes, hands you a piece of paper and says, I need you to sign this. That's the one
that I'm like, do that.
No, yeah. I'm leaving.
But I've actually had people come to the office and try to, like, without an appointment, without talking, they just walk. When I was at Funcom, they just walk into our office and be like, hey, I want to talk to this person about this. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you don't ever do that. That puts a bad taste in your mouth. So there's a difference between being.
I like appreciate the initiative, though.
Yeah, but
I mean, there's a good bit of hustle that goes into that, that would
going to conventions is also a great, like, there are set up areas of conventions that you can pitch ideas to people and do sit downs, these quick pitches, where you go from chair to chair, and doing that kind of stuff is amazing. It'll actually help you with your pitch game. Like, doing those type of events will get you in front of a lot of people. And I mean, that happens all over the place. It happens at GDC. It happens at Gamescom. It happens, even it happens at Gen Con. Like there's so many conventions that you could do those type of pitching, have those pitching opportunities at. So
I will take the time to do a shameless plug and say that is something actually the Powell Group does. We will go and find an IP for your game, and we work with a lot of IP companies to find games to do those, work with those IPs. The biggest thing that I always tell developers is just ask, because there's so many IP. We have entered that stage where our industry is very attractive to a lot of IP holders. You don't know until you ask. If you want to acquire one for your game, that's what I did with our very first casual game with the, you know, my first startup company. But just reach out and say, hey, look, this is what I want to do. If you want to be at the end-all, be-all place for talking to all of these companies, go to the licensing show in Vegas. Unlike GDC, a ticket is free. You know, you just
pay. I think it's in May. I think it's the end of May.
I haven't been in several
years. I want to say May 20.
It is like an early summer out there, but that is where everybody related to licensing is. And you can literally just walk around from booth to booth and say, hey, look, I make games and we want to do it. I mean, it's the biggest thing is just ask. I mean, that's,
and I know it's hard for a lot of people. Like, I am an extrovert. I like to talk to people. I know it's hard if you're a game developer. Sometimes you may be an introvert and it may be difficult for you to do, but you have to do it. You're going to have to ask. I've got four kids and they're like, Dad, you talk to everybody. And I'll talk to people all the time about anything, but it's gotten me where I am today because I like to have conversations with people. I'm not pushy with it, but I like to talk to people. I like to build relationships. I like to communicate. I think my team likes the fact that I can over communicate, or everybody is on the same page on my studio because communication is key, and talking and being open and honest with people. I mean, that's an absolute key to any business.
Yeah. And again, and especially this one where there is so much connection-based work that happens. And speaking of connections, Occupational's got a very quick question. Are you hiring or will you be hiring?
So I mentioned before that we have a staffing plan. We have to get out of the different phases of our development. So yes, I will be hiring people when we go into pre-production and production. I will need people of all specialties in game development. So yes, I don't know when that will be just yet. I have rough ideas, but yes, I will be hiring at least two more times to develop our Brilliant Ruin game.
So how is growing, walk us through the difference between growing a studio like Funcom from, you know, 200 to 450 people and growing something like Studio Hermitage where you're shooting for 25.
Yeah.
What's
finding the right people. It's finding the right people. It's finding those journalists. At Funcom, we needed to have AI programmers. We needed to have systems designers. So we needed those specialists because we were doing something on a much bigger scale. A small studio, we need the generalists. And finding the right people is paramount to your team. Finding the people that can multitask, but also that fit in with you and your team. I am all about having a diverse team. I love having different ideas and different mindsets. I'm not all about having, you know, the same type of people. I also don't like ego. So I've worked over the years with studios that have had people with huge egos, and I don't think that there's a place for that. I like an ego-free environment where people feel like they're being heard, the entire team. The wonderful thing about working with my team, and Justin Achille, I'll talk to you if you ever watch this. I don't know if you will, but he's our chief creative officer. He does not have an ego, and this is a guy that's created really amazing IPs over the past 30 years. But he listens to everybody about everything. So when our team created our IP, we had a senior concept artist that was just creating characters and creating things, and he put backstories to it. Justin just took those characters and said, these are great. I'd love to put them in the world. He took our characters, like even the ones that I've created. My son has created a character in Arbor Room because he's like, Dad, I'd love to create this guy that lost his arm to this vampire, but he still feels the ruin, and he's now a character in our world because Justin doesn't have that ego where he's like, no, this is my game. This is how I'm doing it. These are the stories that I want to tell. So I think that when you build a team, you have to find the right people with the right environment and just enable those people to be heard and listened to and take their ideas into consideration and use them. So everybody from my team, I think that they feel like they're listened to, they're heard, they're empowered. So I think that's extremely valuable.
So are you all remote or do you have an office?
Yeah, we're 100% remote right now. And like, there's only 14 of us at Studio Hermitage right now. So we are 100% remote. I would say 65 to 70% of us are in Raleigh, the Raleigh, North Carolina area. We do meet up every so often, and there is we will probably get an office space, but we're always going to be a hybrid studio. I have employees in Georgia and Texas and Kansas and Pennsylvania and Canada. So, I mean, we have people all over. So
how do you manage, this is obviously a more important question over the last 4 or 5 years. How do you go about finding that culture fit and, you know, who's going to fit in with the studio when you're doing it remote and you're not like sitting in an office and seeing these people every single day?
That's a great question. So I've had the luxury of hiring people for studios for the past 15 years. So I've built, like, I helped Tripwire build the Killing Floor team. I've helped Firaxis build the XCOM team. Like, I know, you talk to the hiring managers, you find what they're looking for. You hunt down people that not only have the skills that are needed to do the job, but you find the personality fits. So you know what a studio's environment's like. Like, you know that if they swear, you give somebody a shit test and you say shit in an interview and you see how they react, because you know the studio's environment, they swear sometimes. So there are things like that happen that you have to figure out for that team. And every team is unique, and finding the right people that fit on that team is important. So for me, I kind of know what I'm looking for with team members. I know that I'm trying to find people that that are passionate about what they do, that like to talk, that can communicate very well, that are open and honest. One of the best books I read is called Radical Candor. It's all about being open, honest, and radically candid with people and building a relationship. So I make sure that people, you know, you build trust with people and you're open and honest with them. So that's something that I always try to find. I find people that are open and honest. And it is hard in a remote environment, but I had my entire team do the interview process with me. So I took everybody's feedback into consideration when we were doing hiring, for the most part. So I got feedback and we kind of looked at red flags and we said, would this person work? Would this person not work? So we all talked it out. It wasn't just one person. It wasn't just me saying, I'm hiring this person because I think they'd be a good fit. I like to have the entire team have feedback and say into who we're hiring and who we're bringing on. So.
But I'm open and honest, and people refer to me as an asshole. I don't get the.
There's maybe a difference there, Jay. I mean, it's having couth, you know, presenting yourself.
Yes. It's like my wife says, I don't have that filter. Just because you think it doesn't mean you need to say it. It's like, well, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I have family members that like to put their feet in their mouth, and I've learned over the years that you have to be mindful of the things that you say to people. So just think it out first.
Yes, you have to be politely honest.
Yes,
that's the catch. Paxton, this has been fantastic, and I have truly enjoyed this. And when you get up to my side of the woods, give me a shout, and we'll get together, and I'll do the same next time I'm down.
Like I said, I go snowboarding all the time up there. So,
let me know, because I can literally walk the slope, so we're good. Yeah. We're perfectly fine. Final plugs, anything else you want to point people to?
Yeah, so our website is studio-hermitage.com. Our IP's website is ourbrilliantruin.com. If anybody wants to connect with me on LinkedIn, I am always open to connecting. I think I have 15,000 people on LinkedIn that I'm connected to. So I love connecting on LinkedIn. So please feel free to connect with me there. Just follow Our Brilliant Ruin, you know, be on this journey with us, this transmedia journey. You know, if there's an aspect that you that you gravitate toward, that would make me happy. So
awesome. Thank you. And for everybody else, if you want to learn more about all the wonderful resources that we have at Indie Game Business here that are all free or super, super cheap for you, just go to our brand new website, indiegamebusiness.com. Links to the podcast, the videos, the conference sessions, the online classes that we have for free. Dan has this much more, you know, put together than I do when I have to wrap all this up. So go to indiegamebusiness.com. And if you're interested in the consulting stuff that we do, go to the Powell Group, powellgroupconsulting.com. And with that, we're going to leave you, and we will see you next week. And hope everyone has a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jay. Everybody.
Thank you.